Merrick Garland added, Mr. Smith will begin his work as special counsel immediately. Though many anticipated such an appointment, the move is not without controversy. Justice Department officials have spent months in the January 6 matter, more than a year, examining the details of Donald Trump's alleged misdeeds, and there's no obvious need to bring in someone new who hasn't been involved in the probe up until now. Many have argued that such a move is politically necessary. In light of Donald Trump's 2024 kickoff, it's unrealistic, the argument goes, to think that President Joe Biden's Attorney General could credibly indict Biden's former and potentially future rival. Naming an independent counsel will offer political insulation against allegations of abuse and reassure the public about the integrity of the process. At least, that's the theory. In practice, there's no reason to believe that Donald Trump and his followers will be impressed. No matter who's overseeing the investigations and scrutinizing the evidence, Republicans will reject the idea that the matter has been handled in a fair and an even-handed way, even if it's been handled in a fair and an even-handed way. Indeed, a spokesperson for the former president's campaign told NBC News, "This is a totally expected political stunt by a feckless, politicized, weaponized Biden Department of Justice."
The story, the closeness of hearts and love. Sometimes wars are silent and hidden with an attractive and charming look. Such wars are sometimes more threatening and result in more victims. Like the war that I want to tell you about. A war that you may not have even imagined, but we are in the middle of the battlefield. I want to start my story with a question. Why is fast food so popular in this era? One recipe and one taste. Everything is similar. Ready-to-eat foods are without stories because there is no time to tell stories in the middle of the battlefield. We can find them in these hypermarkets. There is no story here. The story of each product is summarized in barcodes and a few lines and numbers below them. It doesn't matter where the food comes from. They say here instead of everywhere. Here, like on the battlefield, everything happens fast. Undoubtedly, every food has a story, even if we don't have time to hear it. Foods sometimes make up their own stories, which are sometimes scary and bitter. The scary story of Zahak started from the kitchen. Foods have their own stories and make up other stories, like potatoes. The potato. How the Humble Spud Rescued the Western World is the name of a book by Larry Zuckerman. It is about the potato and its relationship with the Industrial Revolution. Who would believe that potatoes played a key role in one of the biggest events in human history? I asked Larry Zuckerman how potatoes suddenly became a widespread food in the world.
So I would not say that it caused the Industrial Revolution, but I would go so far as to say that in England, it helped make the Industrial Revolution possible because it sustained the people who were doing the industry. When factory workers got off shift, the last thing they really wanted to do was cook. And right outside the factory gates were people who had set up carts with ovens, and they would bake the potatoes. And they would sell them for cheap, and people would have a hot baked potato coming right off the factory floor, a nice instant treat. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of modern street food. So the pace of life began to increase. I think the industrialization happened first, and the potato became necessary for it to continue or made it easier.
The potato story was about pace. Life had become too fast. In that era, people were in a hurry for everything. Street food was a new way to save time. Street foods are prepared in the shortest time and can be eaten anywhere. Then there was enough time for people to do more important things than cooking and eating. In those days, people tried to spend their time to produce more products. After many years doing the same thing, people realized that they were producing much more goods than they needed. People had to consume more goods because production was increasing. Otherwise, there would be no production. In this way, humans enter the era of mass consumption. Mass production and consumption meant that previous methods had to be changed. For example, the chicken meat and beef consumed by humans were obtained from farms in the past, but in that era, the farms could not supply this amount of meat anymore. So industrial livestock production came into existence. Animal husbandry describes how animals gain a lot of weight in a short time. For example, the weight that chickens gain in 6 weeks in today's industrial poultry farming is almost twice the weight that chicks gained in the same period of time 50 years ago in farms. This rapid growth of chicken in a short time and under unusual conditions inflicted a lot of pain on them in their short life, kind of pain that few people have heard about. Earlier I said that foods in the new supermarkets do not have a story, but it is better to say that they have a story, but it is not written anywhere. Peter Singer. He's one of the greatest philosophers in the world. He wrote a book on the story of pain. In his book, Animal Liberation, he talks about the great pain that industrial animal production inflicts on animals. This is the last chapter of the short life of industrial chickens. I asked Peter Singer what made a philosopher like him write a book about the short and painful life of these animals.
Well, I am primarily concerned about the suffering we inflict on animals. I think we should not do that as an ethical imperative. I think in the way we treat animals, especially in factory farms, it is indisputable. So many people, when they think about animals being farmed, they think of animals outside grazing in the fields. But unfortunately, over the past 50 years, in many countries, animals, or most animals, are no longer in the fields.
Can you give us a talk about the suffering imposed, for example, to hens in factory farming?
In some cases, the confinement is very tight. An example of that would be for hens who are laying eggs. So the standard industrial cage, and that's not just for one hen, that might be for four or five hens. So each hen in this cage has just a very small amount of space. They're very crowded together and they can't even stretch their wings. In fact, some of the cages are so small that even one bird in the cage could not stretch her wings fully. And instead of there being one bird, there are four or five birds.
Mass and high-speed production of food was not possible without the help of machines, so foods were produced by machines. Machines did not show mercy to animals either. It means that humans did not program the machines for such aim. Important that animals had souls, emotions, and feelings. From then on, animals were just goods that had to be reproduced, sold, and consumed rapidly. Whatever Peter Singer explained about the industrial animal production in chicken's case fits about cows and calves and industrial cattle farming too. It refers to raising a large number of cows in very large dairy farms with conditions that were unimaginable before this era. In these farms, cows have to eat more to grow faster. Fast production of meat and milk should be done in any possible way. There had to be changes in the stomach or the feeding method of cows so that they could eat more and more. Cows couldn't grow as fast as possible by eating natural fodder, considering the amount of market demand. So farmers had to look for other materials for cow feed. So corn became a key element in the cow's growth. This large amount of corn had to be produced so that they could eat and grow faster. The new issue was the mass production of corn. This amount of corn should have been produced in the shortest time. Statistics of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations show the world production of corn increased sevenfold between 1995 and 2005. This rapid growth was achieved at the cost of the destruction of a large part of the Amazon forest and other arable lands of this planet. According to statistics, 67% of the world's agricultural lands have been infertile. The cruel cycle of industrial meat production does not spare even oil, and they use a large amount of this fossil fuel for tractors and food delivery trucks. According to the statistics, it takes 5 barrels of oil to grow a beef cattle. Numbers show for every 120 grams of beef, 7.5 square meters of fertile forests are destroyed, and as a result, 240 kilograms of carbon dioxide are released. More and faster production of food causes a lot of suffering for animals and also causes a lot of damage to nature. One out of eight people in today's world is either very fat or very thin. The rest of the people may not be fat or thin, but they do not use diverse nutrition resources. It means that in today's world, everyone is hungry in some way, even if they don't know it themselves. Considering the amount of destruction of Earth and the resources and this amount of mass production of food, why should people be hungry? Mass and abundant production cannot be a warning. The age of mass production. In this era, mass profit was only possible with mass production. So every obstacle in the way of mass production had to be removed. Machine-processed foods were the same in size and ingredients. They were produced and consumed with the same strategy. This means that the consumer's tastes should have been similar to each other. From then on, the good food was cooked as fast as possible and was also easy to eat. The hero of this story was sausage. Sausage is a standardized food that everyone without any taste likes. Its components cannot be distinguished from each other, and it can be produced and consumed very quickly. But food like calipoche has characteristics that make it different from sausage. It is not a dish that everyone likes. It takes a long time to cook this dish. The ones who eat this kind of meal know exactly what they're going to eat. If I want to eat sheep's eyes, I know exactly what part of the sheep I want to eat. I can know about the different parts of a sheep's body. Many don't like this dish and never enter a tabakhi. In a tabakhi, the cook plays a very important role. Most of the time, he is the hero of the story. Customers know the story of calipoche with its cook. The green eyes of the cook are part of the taste of the food that is eaten. Concept like local customers was against the trend that wanted to make food global. The good food is loved by all people everywhere in the world. Food that can be mass produced, mass sold, and mass profitable. The new era is about machines and pace. In this period, the good food is in harmony with machines. It means that it can be produced with the help of a machine and can be eaten in cars. The story of unifying the tastes of all the people of the world started from serving food inside of vehicles. McDonald's was the first restaurant that started serving food in the cars. An idea that, after a few decades, turned this restaurant into the second largest private restaurant in the world. Now McDonald's has 37,800 branches in 119 countries. These branches provide food with similar tastes to 64 million customers around the world on a daily basis. McDonald's quickly removed taste and chef from the story of food. In this age, no one asks himself why all the people everywhere in the world should love the same kind of food. This fast food company went beyond a way of consuming food and became a lifestyle. George Ritzer, American sociologist, uses McDonaldization as a new concept to explain McDonald's impacts on different communities. He believes that McDonald's influence is expanded. In this opinion, in the new age, everything is becoming part of McDonaldization. Speed is a modern phenomenon that has become a disaster for human lives and the Earth. Speed in food production and consumption means harming Mother Earth. It means the ruination of water, soil, and the environment. Fast food causes the loss of diversity and cultural values and even increases the number of hungry people, and it harms people's health. Many years passed until they knew about this widespread destruction. People looked for a quick solution to prevent this destruction. Preventing widespread meat eating and finding an alternative to it was the first thing that came to their minds in this era. So movements were formed to announce this alternative. These movements, which are sometimes accompanied by famous figures, seek to eliminate animal meat and replace it with other creatures. Insects are one of the serious proposals to be used instead of the meat of animals. Those people who are the fans of entomophagy believe the land and resources used to produce 200 grams of beef are equal to the land and resources used to grow 2,000 grams of insects. So it is probably better to raise and eat insects to raise cattle. Vegan-friendly restaurants are expanding with this idea. In these restaurants, the food has a look of meat, but with vegetables as its components. This restaurant only serves vegetarian meals, and it is full of things that reminds us of former times. Television was slowly forgotten by the rise of social media. The age of television was the age of mass production, and the era of social media is a period of mass consumption. In this era, everything is related to illustration. The value of products are determined by the attractiveness of their images. In the era of image consumption, McDonald's, which invited everyone to eat the same type of food, gradually fell out of favor, giving way to tasters who advertise foods with a completely different appearance. In this new battlefield, these tasters give the order to attack. Sauce, cheese, and Instagram. If these three items are properly put together, they can do miracles in the age of visualization of the world. Prayer for the Whale is the name of a film about food. Food of Alaskan people who eat whale meat. But before hunting a whale, they pray with it. They believe that the whale gives itself to the hunters. I asked Kili Yuyan, the director of the film, about these strange customs and beliefs.
He's saying, thank you to the whales for coming back year after year. Thank you for giving yourselves. The Nyupyak always say that the whale is giving itself to you. And you can really see that the whaling is good for the food. It's part of the community. It's culturally very powerful because it's the primary source of identity. Also, you know, there are whaling cultures, so they feel very much tied to the whale. The fate of the whale is the fate of the people. And so all of that is 100% integrated.
It seems that whaling is something tough to do. Didn't people of that region try to change their diet to get rid of whaling difficulties?
No, you know, Inuit peoples eat all meat. And it's very difficult for outsiders to understand that that is a necessary part of life. And that's how, culturally speaking, that's important.
People who pray for their food, people who eat meat, but do not disturb the balance of nature and environment. People whose identity and culture are mixed with the food they eat. Kiliyuyan believes that we will approach the balance if the intermediaries are removed and humans establish direct contact with the earth. This is not an easy task in today's world. How can one think about reducing the distance between the man and the earth in the world of profit, speed, and capital? Mohammed Qayyim Pana has taken good steps to reduce this gap. Mohammed tries to reduce the distance between farmer and consumer with an innovative idea and by establishing a startup. The story of the product is the story of who, where, and how each product was grown and produced. These stories make other new stories, different stories. The story you heard was not the story of war. It was a story of the closeness of hearts and love. But the war is still going on. Man's war with himself, with animals and plants, and with the earth. We may not have started this war, but we are definitely involved in its fate. The continuation of this war depends on the choices we make for our daily food.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Recently, Saudi Arabia's King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, as part of reshuffling the country's cabinet, appointed Mohammed bin Salman as the head of Riyadh's Council of Ministers. During this appointment, the Saudi Crown Prince's lawyers told the American court that the new position of Mohammed bin Salman as the head of the Council of Ministers will give him judicial immunity from prosecution in the case of Jamal Khashoggi's murder. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper has covered this story. The U.S. Department of State has given Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity from a lawsuit over the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, despite President Biden's earlier promise to hold the de facto ruler accountable for the crime. In a statement on Thursday, 17th of November, the U.S. State Department announced that it recognizes and allows the immunity. Citing its constitutional authority as well as customary international law, the U.S. State Department said Prime Minister bin Salman, as a sitting head of government, is immune while in office from the jurisdiction of the United States District Court in this lawsuit. Atif Cengiz, the fiancé of the murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was also the founder of Democracy for Arab World Now, has filed a lawsuit over the terrible murder in the Federal District Court of Washington, D.C. The lawsuit charges that Khashoggi, a U.S. resident and a Washington Post columnist, was tortured, murdered, and dismembered under orders of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The CIA has previously confirmed that the Saudi Crown Prince was in fact personally behind the murder. Back in late September, Mohammed bin Salman was named as Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia in a move that experts believe was linked to the lawsuit in a bid to shield him from legal prosecution. Reacting to the new development and while using the hashtag injustice, Atif Cengiz took to Twitter and wrote, "Jamal died again today. We thought maybe there would be a light to justice from USA, but again, money came first." Meanwhile, the executive director of Dawn, Sarah Leah Whitson, also slammed the Biden administration's decision as a capitulation to Saudi pressure tactics. She wrote in a separate post on Twitter, "It's beyond ironic that President Biden has single-handedly assured Mohammed bin Salman can escape accountability when it was President Biden who promised the American people he would do everything to hold him accountable. Not even the Trump administration did this." President Biden came under fire back in July for fist-bumping Mohammed bin Salman on a visit to Saudi Arabia to discuss energy and security issues. Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad in the Saudi Arabia's consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, in October of 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the kingdom and its crown prince. The Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, concluded back in 2018 that Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the murder of Khashoggi, contradicting Saudi Arabia's insistence that the crown prince had no prior knowledge of the plot. The Saudi prince has denied ordering Khashoggi's murder, but acknowledged later that it took place under my watch. Saudi officials later blamed rogue agents for the murder. The website of Middle East Monitor has also covered the same story. The US decision that has granted Mohammed bin Salman sovereign immunity in a lawsuit over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi means that despite the certainty of the US intelligence community that the 37-year-old Mohammed bin Salman authorized the murder in 2018, any prospect of holding the Crown Prince legally accountable for the killing is blocked. In a filing released on Thursday, 17th of November, the Biden administration said the Crown Prince's recent promotion to the role of Prime Minister meant that he was the sitting head of government and accordingly immune from lawsuit filed by Khashoggi's fiancée, Atif Cengiz, in March of last year. The Department of Justice claimed in its court filing, "The United States government has expressed grave concerns regarding Jamal Khashoggi's horrific killing and has raised these concerns publicly with the most senior levels of the Saudi government," adding that the United States has also imposed financial sanctions and visa restrictions related to the murder. The U.S. Department of Justice added, "However, the doctrine of a head of state immunity is well established in customary international law and has been consistently recognized in long-standing executive branch practice as a status-based determination that does not reflect a judgment on the underlying conduct at issue in the litigation. The decision is seen as another sign of capitulation by the Biden administration and President Biden himself, who came into office describing the Saudi kingdom as a pariah state and saying he would hold the crown prince to account for the murder. His trip to Riyadh in July of this year, which critics described as a humiliation for the US president, was the first sign of a U-turn by the Biden administration. Democracy for the Arab World Now says the Biden administration's suggestion of immunity for Mohammed bin Salman isn't just a mistake as a matter of law, it's a mistake as a matter of policy. Sarah Leah Whitson of Dawn said, "The Biden administration's decision to suggest immunity for Mohammed bin Salman in our lawsuit was an unnecessary elective action that will serve only to undermine the most important action for accountability for Jamal Khashoggi's heinous murder." The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Dawn is a co-plaintiff in the case, with charge that Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other Saudi officials acted in a conspiracy and with premeditation when Saudi agents kidnapped, bound, drugged and tortured and killed Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey in October of 2018. The Biden administration's decision, which in effect will extinguish Hatice Cengiz's last hope for justice, will likely be met with intense criticism by Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who have pressed the administration to take a tougher line against its West Asian partner. One lawyer close to the matter said the decision was disastrous for accountability, for human rights and for impunity. The legal decision also makes clear that US President Joe Biden has fully abandoned the campaign promise to hold the Saudi crown prince accountable for Khashoggi's murder. People familiar with the matter said the decision was reached after a big debate at the top levels of the White House, with some senior U.S. officials arguing that it will be difficult to defend the Biden administration's claim that human rights are at the center of its foreign policy, while simultaneously allowing Mohammed bin Salman to skirt accountability for his alleged role in the murder. It has been clear since June that the future of the case hinged on a question of whether, in the eyes of the US government, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, widely seen as Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, was considered a sovereign, like a president or a king, since in most cases sovereigns are considered immune from US lawsuits. When Biden first entered the White House, he declined to engage with Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly. His press secretary argued repeatedly at the time that the prince, though seen as Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, was not Biden's counterpart. At the same time, U.S. intelligence agencies released an unclassified report that said Prince Mohammed had ordered Jamal Khashoggi's murder.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
For weeks, Iran has witnessed unrest and riots in its different cities. The unrest started after a young woman named Mahsa Amini fainted in police custody and later died in hospital. The protests were initially peaceful, but violent elements supported by Western spy agencies hijacked the protests and turned into violent riots. The unrest has provided the fertile ground for Western governments and spy agencies to launch a media warfare on Iran and create anti-Iran fake news. A recent notorious case in point is the recent tweet by Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In the controversial tweet, the Canadian Premier had claimed that Iran has sentenced 15,000 protesters to death. The false claim, which has been part of the media campaign against Iran, has been circulating on social media in recent days. The inaccurate tweet was live on Trudeau's official Twitter account for almost 12 hours before it was deleted. Several Western celebrities and news outlets, including the Newsweek, also shared the erroneous information. This is not the only case of false news propagated against Iran. When the protests first started in Iran, Western-backed propaganda outlets claimed that Mahsa Amini was beaten to death by Iranian police forces. Following an elaborate investigation, that claim also proved to be false. It's now become a common practice for these propaganda machines to publish unverified footages on protests in Iran. Back in September 2022, US media outlets ran a controversial report. The report was widely discussed and celebrated in anti-Iran outlets. But it turned out to be a fake report after Ayatollah Khamenei publicly attended a military ceremony in Tehran in October. The false report was propagated by Western outlets as Iran was battling the Western-backed riots. Social media platforms have also turned into a battleground of narratives against Iran. Analysis shows those tweeting the hashtags associated with the unrest showed a striking number of new accounts created since the protests started.
In August 2011, when there were riots in London because someone was shot and killed by the police, a number of people were killed. I don't recall the exact number. But big tech, Facebook, back then BlackBerry, and Twitter cooperated with the British government. In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments, even though in the riots in London, people were killed, okay, and they arrested people and put them in jail for inciting riots. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
The online anti-Iran campaign is fed by fake accounts used by members of the anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terrorist cult who are stationed in Albania and so-called journalists employed by the Saudi-funded London-based Iran International TV, which is now on Tehran's terror blacklist. The television channel has openly been promoting monarchists, the highly notorious MKO terror group, and most significantly, separatist terrorists. A particular case in point is a project by Western media outlets to accuse the government of killing its own citizens. They have produced a long list of citizens which they claim have been killed by security forces.
Iran has witnessed another deadly terrorist attack. The latest deadly incident happened in the city of Izeh in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on civilians and security forces, killing several people, including a child and an elderly woman. The terror attack also left a number of people injured. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the assault. President Ebrahim Raisi has condoled with the families of the victims, ordering security officials to identify and bring to justice all terrorists behind the attack. The senior judicial official says three people who were behind the brutal attack were arrested. The special operation is going on to identify and to bring to justice other people involved in the attack in the city of Izeh. Separately, a religious seminary school in the Izeh city was set ablaze by a group of rioters. No one was injured in that incident. Separately, three people were killed and eight security forces injured during riots in Semirom in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. Two security forces also killed and two others wounded in the city of Malikshahr in Isfahan province. Last month, a terrorist attack happened in the city of Shiraz. On October 26th, a terrorist attacked the popular Shia shrine of Shah Cheragh in Iran's southwestern province of Fars, killing over a dozen people. That attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The attacks come amid ongoing foreign-backed riots that have hit various Iranian provinces after a 22-year-old Kurdish woman named Mahsa Amini died in the hospital despite intensive medical care and resuscitation efforts. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Iran says the attacks are part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says security services, the Israeli regime, and certain Western politicians are conspiring to trigger a civil war in Iran to destroy and to disintegrate the country. He warned them that Iran is not Libya or Sudan. He also noted that the enemies are targeting Iran's territorial integrity and identity, saying that Iran will not allow anyone to jeopardize national security. The terrorist attack comes amid Western attempts to stoke unrest in Iran and to create more economic hardships for the Iranian people. Late last month, Iran's main intelligence bodies reported that the U.S., backed by the U.K., Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other allies, are devising a multidimensional plot for instigating riots in the Islamic Republic and directing the wave of violence.
We are telling our enemies, the U.S., Britain, the Saudis, these are the ones that, through their destructive media outlets, they are targeting our revolution. We are warning them that we will break you, we will crush you, you will not find any way into this territory.
Western countries expressed their open support for rioters and acts that Tehran described as inciting violence and hatred. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the recent riots. Recently, the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton confirmed that subversive groups in Iran, which he characterized as the opposition, are being armed with weapons imported from Iraq's Kurdistan.
The United States should take history as a mirror and let it guide the future. That's what the Chinese President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart Joe Biden on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia.
As always, I'm ready to have a candid and in-depth exchange of views with Mr. President on issues of strategic importance in China-U.S. relations and major global and regional issues at our meeting today. I also look forward to working with you to bring China-U.S. relations back to the track of healthy and stable development.
We share a responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
The two held their first ever in-person meeting as relations between Washington and Beijing are at their lowest in decades, marred by disagreements over a host of issues from Taiwan to trade. During the landmark three-hour meeting, the Chinese president warned his U.S. counterpart not to cross Beijing's red line over Taiwan. According to the Chinese state media, Xi stressed that Taiwan is the bedrock of the political foundation of bilateral relations. Biden, for his part, said the U.S. wants to manage differences with China to prevent competition from becoming conflict. Biden said he sought to assure Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed, seeking to lower tensions over the self-ruled island.
And I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all. It's the same exact position we've had. I made it clear that we want to see cross-strait issues peacefully resolved.
On North Korea, Biden told Xi that Beijing has an obligation to attempt to talk Pyongyang out of conducting a seventh nuclear test. U.S.-China relations have been strained in recent years by growing tensions over issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea, trade practices, and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Regarding Taiwan, Beijing says it's a matter for the Chinese and China's internal affair. Anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation. Tensions over the self-ruled island have intensified following a provocative visit there in August by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The move prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory, as well as a declaration by the U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing has time and again slammed U.S. provocations, including encouraging and supporting pro-separatist independence forces on the island, saying that Washington has no right to interfere in how to resolve the Taiwan issue. Also, Biden dropped the hammer on China's semiconductor industry by fully implementing a slew of tough controls on the export of American chip technology to China. It would also undermine China's ability to import, manufacture, and export the semiconductors that run the world. The goal was to slow down and prevent Chinese military and technological advances. Washington also takes sides with Beijing's rivals in a maritime dispute in the South China Sea by routinely sending warships and warplanes to the waters to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation. China has repeatedly called on Washington to stop the provocative actions, which undermine peace and stability in the strategic waters. Last month, the White House and the Pentagon declared Beijing as Washington's most serious strategic competitor, in reports outlining U.S. defense and foreign policy strategies. Therefore, despite Biden's meeting with Xi, can the two manage their differences to prevent conflict, or is it inevitable that the two are on the collision course? On Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron held a meeting with a number of U.S.-based anti-Iran figures at the Élysée. Among them, Masih Alinejad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. In the meeting, Macron described the recent riots in Iran as a revolution. Tehran strongly condemned the meeting, with the foreign ministry slamming it as a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani said it's surprising that the president of a country that advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. Western media tried to portray Masih Alinejad as an activist. Reviewing Alinejad's social media posts, one would notice that much of her online activity revolves around the campaign through which she calls on her followers inside Iran to go on the streets, do something to provoke a reaction, record it, and then send the video file to her for online posting. She calls the campaign My Camera is My Weapon, a campaign hoping to achieve polarization, confrontation, and hatred in Iranian society. She's on the U.S. government payroll. Between 2015 and 2022, the U.S. Agency for Global Media paid Alinejad over $628,000 to use her show to push Iranian women into challenging Iranian laws, while also demanding more sanctions against her country. She has been living in the U.S. for the past decade, working as a full-timer for Voice of America Persian, a media outlet directly funded by the U.S. government, made to capitalize on harmful narratives in favor of Washington's interests. It is interesting but not surprising to see Alinejad being hosted in Élysée Palace by French President Macron, who supported a law in his own country to criminalize the filming and dissemination of images showing the face or other identifying characteristics of a member of the National Police, the so-called Global Security Law, with imprisonment of up to 1 year and a fine of up to €45,000 for the offenders. The meeting with Macron was not the first of its kind. In 2019, Alinejad met Mike Pompeo, then U.S. Secretary of State, a hawkish politician with this mindset.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It was like, we had entire training courses.
In 2018, Ahlinejad also joyfully met Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, whose hawkish mindset saw the U.S. sanctions killing of 500,000 Iraqi children as a price worth it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Albright died earlier this year, but the brutal imperialist mindset is still alive and kicking, with the likes of Ahlinejad advocating for more economic terrorism. The organizer of the meeting between Ahlinejad and Macron is the New York-based Justice for Kurds group. The co-founders of this organization are Thomas S. Kaplan and Bernard Henry Levy. In Justice for Kurds, they are pursuing the goal of forming the state of Kurdistan, which is the result of the division of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Levy and Kaplan are both linked to the American hawkish group United Against Nuclear Iran, which pressured pharmaceutical firms to stop selling drugs to Iran amid a massive coronavirus outbreak in the country. Levy is a member, while Kaplan is one of the main funders of the group. Levy and Kaplan have lobbied for the interests of Saudi Arabia and the UAE to sanction Iran. Also, in 2019, a report revealed that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates had paid over $35 million to the UANI and its sister organization, the Counter-Extremism Project, over 2 years. In addition to Kaplan, Sheldon Adelson is one of the top donors to UANI. Reports show that Kaplan and Adelson accounted for over three-quarters of the group's total revenue for 2013. The UANI is one of the organizations that Tehran imposed sanctions on in late October for committing human rights violations, interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, encouraging acts of terror, countering Tehran's moves and attempts to fight terrorism, and mounting pressure on the Iranian nation amounting to economic terrorism.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.